Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, joined as usual by Jeremy Goldhorn, the man behind Danwei.com, the Financial Times company. How are you, Jeremy?
Good evening, Kaiser. I'm very, very well.
So, kanbing nan, getting medical care is expensive and difficult. That's something that people living in China have often said about the healthcare system here. The state of healthcare in the PRC is a fair sight better than it was, or different anyway, than it was in the age of the storied barefoot doctors. While in many ways things have improved, life expectancy has risen to very fast in the years since reform and opening began. The transition to a market economy has left many in the lurch, so that by the year 2000, only about 15% of the population was actually insured. And in 2001, out-of-pocket spending as a total of healthcare spending had reached something like 60%. Major healthcare reforms were undertaken in 2009, though, and at least by some measures, the results have been very impressive. But still, there are deep-seated problems with the healthcare system in China. The quality of care is often quite poor. Some pernicious and corrupt practices persist. Remuneration for healthcare practitioners is still very low. And today, doctors are tragically and all too often made the targets of murderous rage. So today on Seneca, we are delighted to welcome three guests who can help us get a better sense of the state of healthcare in China and a deeper understanding of the public healthcare system reforms that were launched 4 years ago. First up is Dai Lian, a former reporter for the excellent Caixin, who is now executive editor at cn-healthcare.com. Welcome to Seneca, Dai Lian, and I'm very pleased that you could join us.
Thank you. Hello, everyone.
We're also pleased to welcome Benjamin Schobert, who is founder and managing director of Rubicon Strategy Group, who writes on health and senior care issues for the Asia Healthcare blog and contributes to CNBC and Forbes China. Welcome to Seneca, Ben.
Well, thank you for having us.
And finally, we're very honored to have Dr. David Rutstein, who is vice president for medical affairs at United Family Healthcare. Incidentally, both Jeremy and I have children who were born at their hospital in Beijing, Beijing United Family. David is a public health expert and a clinician and former acting deputy surgeon general of the United States. So we are very thrilled to have you with us here, David.
Pleasure to be here.
So before we get started, I wanted to give a very warm thank you to Damian DeNoble, who writes for the Asia Healthcare blog and who is totally instrumental for not only helping us to shape this topic, but for inviting and arranging for our guests on the show today and pointing us to some very good readings ahead of the podcast. So thanks so much, Damian. So, Ben, why don't you start us off? Give us a thumbnail sketch of the history of healthcare, as it were, in the PRC from Mao to now.
Yeah, well, you mentioned a couple of the interesting highlights. It would surprise, I think, a lot of Americans, a lot of Westerners to know that if you compare healthcare outcomes in China from the period when China first opened to the West to today, that healthcare outcomes up until the late 90s, early 2000s were actually running behind that of a country like Mexico. Mm. So the question that begs is why? And the simple explanation is that China was probably a bit too aggressive in turning over large parts of its state-run healthcare to the private sector. And the idea was that as large state-owned enterprises, as they move to privatize and basically shut down parts of the government-provided healthcare system, the private sector would step up and replace it. That didn't happen. And so what ended up happening in a lot of measures of healthcare outcomes actually deteriorated. And you mentioned several of them relative to out-of-pocket spending actually increased by about 2000, had reached, I think, about 60%. So those things all basically
– Can we – when you, so that's – people are spending more. Are they dying? Are more of them dying? Or
I don't think
are they getting more sick or
– I don't think you could say that more people are dying. I think what you could say is that if you were to compare – healthcare outcomes for China against a country like Mexico during the same period, the healthcare outcomes were broadly worse.
Right. And there was a realization, of course, of this problem in the 2000s, in the aughts. There was a move toward healthcare reform, and that culminated, of course, with the reforms that were promulgated first in 2008, floated to the public for general commentary. But before we get too much into those, I wanted to ask Dalia, the concept of healthcare on the part of the Chinese government, is it regarded as a public service that should be provided by the state, or is it something that maybe should be subject to the whims and the dictates of the market economy today?
Actually, most of the healthcare service is provided by the public organizations, the public hospitals. But still, I think nearly 12% of the beds of hospital is provided by the private sectors. Mm-hmm. And now, even just a study from 2010, the government started to encourage the private sectors and also foreign sectors to invest on the private hospitals. Yeah.
Where people like David come in. So, David, on the surface, China seems to have made very remarkable progress looking at 2006 versus 2011 numbers here. I'm very impressed. I mean, total healthcare expenditures more than doubled, and total number of people with insurance went from 49% to over 95%. Mm-hmm. What does it mean, though, to be insured here? I mean, that can mean, I imagine, very many, many different things. There's my insurance policy working for, you know, a fairly wealthy company in a reasonably high position. And then there's the insurance
So on the face of it, you know, I should start off by saying that what China has achieved in a relatively short period of time with regarding health reform is quite remarkable, given that it has the size of the population that it does have.
Sure.
And the sheer breadth and width of the country, the disparity between rural and urban dwellers, and the rapid aging of the population. So China has made some remarkable gains, but these problems that exist are just tremendous. And I think when we start talking about the financing of health care through insurance, it's one thing to say that 95% of the population has some kind of insurance coverage. That's wonderful. But when you look at the amount of coverage that breaks down to per capita, it's a very small amount,
mm-hmm.
meaning that the out-of-pocket expenditures as a percentage of rising costs are actually higher than they were a decade ago per patient.
So,
can I interrupt? Because I'm still not satisfied with the answer to my question. Like, are people dying? Like, let's compare it to Africa. You know, say South Africa, my home country, you know, where you have like an HIV infection rate of like, say, a third of the population. This is clearly not an ideal healthcare outcome, where, you know, it's very difficult to actually get treatment, you know, whether you have money or not in certain places. Let's compare it with America, where, as I understand it, you go into a hospital, if you don't have insurance or cash, they might just turf you out. Or compare it with India, which I have no experience of, or Europe, where you can get free treatment. What is the experience like in China for two kinds of people, I would ask? One, if you're a peasant with no money and, you know, not from a rich place. And then what is it like if you're a resident of Beijing or Shanghai or another big city? Could we ask like that? Just what is the basic situation?
Okay. Actually, I don't think it's so bad in China now. People now, just according to the life expectancy and the mortality, morbidity, actually maybe the whole number, the life expectancy is increased and the mortality is decreased. Yeah. But still, like David said, still very tremendous problems, especially about the insurance. For example, for a resident in a rural area, now, just from 2000, they can be covered by the new rural insurance. Now, most of citizens are covered, but still, the out-of-pocket rate is nearly 50%. It's a very high rate. And also, like David said, maybe the money they should pay is much more than before. Because before, 10 years, decades ago, they can choose not go to hospital. But now, they choose go to hospital, so they pay more.
Right. Is this because of deductibles or co-payments? Or what's the culprit here?
It's all of the above.
Okay.
But increasingly, the very cost of care has risen.
Mm. Right.
Right? So the cost of care has outpaced even the aggressive insurance coverage.
Mm.
And then the answer to your question really is depends on which China you're talking about. Mm. Are you talking about the urban people? That the answer is very different than the huge number of people 50% or more of the population that live in the countryside.
Could we generalize? I mean, I know it's asking to put a lot into a little, but I mean, if you're in the countryside, it's better than America or worse?
Worse.
Much worse.
Much worse.
Better than Uganda?
Actually, here's an interesting statistic. China has fewer flush toilets than sub-Saharan Africa.
Wow.
Okay. So we're sitting here in Beijing, and that's, you know, unheard of.
Well, the studio here isn't actually a flush toilet. It really doesn't. It doesn't have a flush toilet.
But you get my point, right?
Right.
There are really two Chinas. And so if the national data aggregates it into averages, but those averages don't.
But then could, I mean, I'm trying to get a sense of how bad things are in the countryside. Could we compare it to, say, the Central African Republic or Somalia? Is it that bad?
I think there's some disparities in the countryside too, right?
Sure.
But I can tell you that that there are vast areas in China that are not the first world. And so the solutions, and this is why it's, in my opinion, it's remarkable what China has achieved so far in that it has to cope with a very rapid, vibrant, emerging economy on the in Shanghai, Beijing, and other tier one cities, at the same time coping with these vast tracts of villagers and villages that aren't nowhere near that way.
And so, then, so sorry, the second part, just and then I'll be done with my kind of obsessive quest to understand this. But so in the cities then, is it America, is it Sweden, is it France? You know, where are we in the cities? If you're, and let's talk about really the top tier cities, Beijing, Shanghai, Shenzhen.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I mean, that would depend on how much money you have, right?
Exactly. It depends on access. I can tell you that if that from a technical point of view, some of the greatest collection of medical technology exists in some of the university hospitals in Beijing and Shanghai. And if you have the resources, you can get the most cutting-edge surgeries and latest chemotherapies and other high-tech interventions. The problem is not the accumulation of technology, though. It's the it's combining all of these systems into a workable and consistent system. Because healthcare is not just technology, but it's actually how you manage people, how you employ them, how you incentivize them, and how you can measure quality and outcomes. And by all of those things I just said, it doesn't really exist at any consistent level yet.
Well, Jeremy, I think what you're getting at is you remember the days when you and I were both sort of quasi-slacker, sort of relatively impoverished, and we would, you know, go to the hospital in the middle of the night, past a lot of elderly people groaning on gurneys, all of them with IVs stuck in their arms, and, you know, guahao and wait for 3 hours before seeing anyone. Paying, you know, less generally than you did for the cab fare to get there, but the quality of care, let us say, in even some of Beijing's better hospitals, public hospitals, that is, wasn't so good. Is that what you were sort of?
Partly, but you know, it's odd because I back in the 90s, I also remember being very sick in a village near Ili in the very very far west of Xinjiang, middle of nowhere, very poor place. And going into a clinic where there was a kind of a somebody who had a white coat. And, you know, they may have killed me, but they had a big supply of antibiotics. And there were people who had read, you know, two books and kind of could diagnose four diseases, which was quite impressive compared to places I've seen in other poor countries. So and then, you know, you read the American press about the American healthcare system, and it sometimes can seem like maybe it's – if you're just – Mr. Wang, average Joe in Beijing, compared to Mr. Smith, you know, in Chicago, maybe it's not that bad here. That's what I'm trying to ask.
I think it would be fair to say though that if you were to put yourself in, you know, grab any disease out of the bucket that you want to and walk into – have your choice of either walking into a Chinese hospital or an American hospital. Even if you're of similar low economic means, I think you'd rather
be in America.
But I think the point that you're getting to is this question of inequities.
Sure.
And that's – if you look at the 12-5-year plan, that's what a lot of this infrastructure build out that's happening is trying to address the inequities that exist in terms of infrastructure and capacity.
That's right. And that brings me to my next question. I mean, there's in the healthcare reform program that has been rolled out, there's a lot of demands placed on local governments to build the infrastructure that's called for. Is part of the problem, as I seem to have read in many places, that local governments just simply don't have the wherewithal to meet that kind of thing?
Yeah. So, Dalia, I think maybe you can speak to this point, but I think it has to do with the overall way that the government has promoted investing in the healthcare infrastructure.
Yeah, actually, I think it is encouraged by the central government just from 2009 to 2011, mm-hmm. invest $850 billion
yuan.
Yeah, to healthcare industry. And this encouraged the local government to invest maybe the same money allocated by the central government. So for the money, they have the money. So how to do? They just do the infrastructure. But the problem is many times the infrastructure cannot solve the problems faced by the patients, such as what you say, the kanbingui, the affordability mm-hmm. and accessibility. And also another new word in China now is kanbingfan, yeah. the complaint for the healthcare service. So it's very important.
Yeah. What about healthcare providers in rural areas? Mm-hmm. I mean, is there a shortage of well-trained doctors, and what sorts of programs are in place to try to encourage people who are graduating from China's mm-hmm. Better medical schools to actually spend time working in rural hospitals?
Yeah, there are always the encouraging programs to encourage better doctors to go to the rural areas, but it's so difficult. The students don't want to go to the rural areas. Even they go to the pharmaceutical companies, mm-hmm. they don't go to the rural areas. There are many problems, many reasons. Maybe one reason is that the different China, as Debbie said, the rural area is so different from city areas. And
sure.
the healthcare sectors, the healthcare organizations in the rural areas is totally different from the hospitals in cities. So the students will think that if they go to their town hospital, they will lose their ability.
They'll never get trained up on the latest equipment.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Latest techniques. Mm-hmm. David, you wanted to add something?
One of the pillars of the latest round of health reform is actually the encouragement of primary care providers and actually setting a target of 150,000 new primary care physicians by 2015.
Mm.
Now, we're in 2013.
Right. Just 2 years.
On average, 3 years of residency to become a primary care physician, sometimes more. So we're not on pace to meet that. But then even if we were, there has to be a realization, exactly as Dalian said, that there are cultural reasons, economic reasons that de-incentivize people going from the cities back to the rural areas. Many countries have faced this and have tried to incentivize students choose them from the rural areas to begin with. They're more likely to return.
Right.
Pay for their education. Even pay them more to go to these places.
This is not even a poor country problem. I know, South Africa, a lot of South African doctors end up working in the boonies in Canada because
no,
Canadian
I think the number that I've heard in China is that for every 600,000 medical students, only 100,000 will actually finish in practice. Mm-hmm. And so if you take, the goal of trying to have 150,000 new primary care physicians by 2015 and that kind of attrition rate, that's a really big goal.
On top of which, there's a cultural issue here. Many patients don't want to go see primary care providers.
Yeah.
So even if you produce them and get them to the countryside, that may not guarantee that people from the countryside won't still bypass the town and municipal and county hospitals to come to Beijing and Shanghai, camp out until they get an appointment with a specialist at PUMC or Xuanwu or Beida or one of the big hospitals.
Now, they're not limited in that. I mean, is that my understanding? Is that they have you're not tied to a healthcare provider the way you might be, say, in the United States, tied to an HMO?
You're not tied, but when you're sick, you want to get the best care you can.
Right.
And if you've heard your whole life that the only way to survive an illness is to get to Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou, or one of the big cities and find the most famous specialist you can, having a brand new graduate primary care provider in your town may not cut it. So this isn't just about producing the numbers. It's about educating the public about the inherent value of primary care.
Yeah, in some ways, the easy part of the healthcare reforms is actually building the facilities mm-hmm. and pushing more people through the training system. Mm-hmm. The hard thing is changing the behavior of how healthcare is consumed.
I see. That's an angle that I hadn't actually thought through before.
Yeah. Another phenomenon just after 2009 is that the hospitals in the rural areas are shrinking. Just after the reform, because the reform way choose a runway in the rural areas, especially the government now control much more than before on the rural areas. But the problem is they pay the total salary for doctors.
Uh-huh.
But the problem is before the doctors are paid by performance or paid by the patients, numbers of patients.
Mm-hmm.
But now the salary is not related to this. Yeah, so they will refuse the patients and ask the patients to go to the up hospitals, such as the town hospitals, the city hospitals. So according to the data, the service provided by the rural hospitals are shrinked, and the county level and the city level
are
a bit higher and higher.
So that's a perverse incentive system then. But it seems like that was put in place to try to address another perverse incentive system, which was generating unnecessary medical tests and unnecessary mm-hmm. because let's talk about this bigger question about how physicians are paid and how they're remunerated here in China. If I am a graduate of a provincial university, say in Zhejiang province, and I go to medical school at a reputable medical school, and then go practice in a middle tier city, what can I expect as a GP? What can I expect to take home?
There's your pay that is the official pay.
Yeah, sure, my official.
And then there's the pay that comes from Hongbao, the red envelope.
Right.
And then there's the pay that you get from the pharmaceutical and device companies.
The sort of
direct
kickbacks, right.
Then there's the pay that you get from the accumulated revenue generated by your department and divvied up every month by the department chair.
Wow.
So obviously, what you're paying taxes on is your direct pay.
Right.
You're not paying taxes on the other. But this is all very anxiety-producing for the physicians. In my view, the physicians in China don't want to practice this way.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. They have very excellent medical schools in China. And physicians have been trained to practice medicine at a very high degree, I think comparable to any country on earth in terms of the medical education. But the infrastructure that is in place to now utilize their services, there's not enough investment in operations, in other words, running facilities.
Right.
There's huge investment in capital expenditures and building them, but actually paying the salaries
administration costs.
So it forces hospitals to raise that revenue in other creative ways,
mm-hmm.
right? And that is through the sale of drugs and other devices and other consumable supplies and dividing it up, paying your physicians a supplement this way so you can keep them. Otherwise, they can't feed their families on the state-mandated salaries.
Dalian, is this Hongbao practice, the red envelopes practice, still very widespread? among physicians in China? Let's say I go to the hospital with my wife and she's delivering a child. Mm-hmm. Would I be expected to pay a bribe, essentially?
Actually, maybe if you go to the university hospitals in Beijing, some very good hospitals, maybe you don't need to pay the hongbao.
Uh-huh.
But normally, yeah.
For any major procedure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe.
Especially specialty procedures, right? That would be, yeah.
So I guess this is all connected with something that I think is a uniquely Chinese phenomenon of patients kind of going postal or going hospital and going on murderous rampages in hospitals, killing doctors and nurses. I suppose the things you've just been saying are some of the causes of this, but would you like to comment on why China has this weird problem of patients killing doctors?
I can comment on it. First of all, it's not unique to China. There are other countries where this happens. I think the statistics I saw in China, though, remember it's a huge population, in 2011, it might have been 2012, there were 17,000 assaults of physicians.
Wow.
in China. And these assaults are very newsworthy, and they capture the attention of not only of the public, but of the rest of the physicians. And they are increasingly anxious about this relationship that has been developed with their patients and nervous that they might be the victim of an assault. Now, why is this happening? The reason, I believe, is because of the way doctors are paid and incentivized. It gets back to their relatively low pay, having to see lots of patients and overprescribe in order to contribute to the pool from which their monthly bonus will be derived. That means, on average, a patient, first of all, they wait a long time to get an appointment with a patient.
Mm-hmm.
When they do, with a physician, when they do see the physician, they have only a few minutes, not a lot of privacy during the encounter. The physician starts writing prescriptions while the patient's still at the door, and tries to do the best they can, coping with this myriad number of patients. By the way, that turns out to be about 70 patients per day.
Oh, Lord.
Right? So if you're seeing that many patients per day, you have only a few minutes with each patient, you write prescriptions very fast, doctor doesn't have a lot of time to kind of practice the art of medicine, the bedside manner, the patient education, the counseling that is so vital to actually producing trust between the patient and the doctor. So patients get frustrated and they take it out on the person sitting in front of them.
What's being done about this? You'd think that this would be a major focus for reform now.
I think the only way that this is going to get fixed is if the compensation system for the doctors and as a byproduct of that, how hospitals are financed, mm-hmm. unless that's addressed. And one of the challenges right now is that the Ministry of Health, in a lot of very good ways, wants to reform these things, but unless the Ministry of Finance steps up and starts to write the checks, it's going to be very difficult for some of the things that David described to actually happen.
But the Ministry of Health is traditionally a very weak ministry, is that correct?
I think that's fair to say.
I mean, I remember reading a piece in preparation for this by a guy named Alex Alex He Jingwei. He suggested that it's traditionally been a very, very weak bureaucracy and wonders whether they will actually have the political will to carry out the sorts of reforms that we're talking about. I mean, they usually do decide with the hospitals, I imagine, who are its political constituency. But they would protect doctors, presumably, or protect hospitals from policies that would set limits on hospital charges. You'd think that would be a good thing, a positive contribution to it, but they're weak, right?
So. Yeah, they're weak. And I think, you know, maybe even another policy that illustrates their weakness is what's happened with drugs. With pharmaceuticals.
Right.
And so if you look at what happened a couple of years ago in the Anhui province, where because of just lack of funding and a recognition that they needed to reform, you know, the role of pharmaceuticals in the hospitals, the Anhui province set in motion this blind bid and tender process, which basically allowed them to very effectively drive down the price of pharmaceuticals. But that policy worked at cross purposes with some of the things that the Ministry of Health wanted to do from a public health point of view. But that's an illustration of, you know, what the local government needed to do to basically make the budget work was not necessarily consistent with what the Ministry of Health wanted to see. And that upset quite a few of the multinationals.
I can imagine. While we're on the topic of the price of drugs, what about these EDLs, these essential drug lists? Can you explain what that is and where this policy came from and what the effect has been? Okay.
So the essential drug list, in the 1980s, mm-hmm. we have the essential drug list, but it is neglected for many years. But in 2009, it restarted this kind of list and push the rural healthcare sectors to use it and only use this list rather than others. Wow. Yeah, the first time, maybe nearly 300 drugs, only 300, but before thousands. So the lack of the drugs are being complained by many, many public. So it is also related to just now I said the shrinking of the rural hospitals.
Right.
Yeah.
Because they're only limited to these 300 essential drugs and they don't have a pharmacopoeia that's capable of dealing.
Yeah.
So there's now 520 on the essential drug list. And the goal, of course, is to try and ensure, first of all, mm-hmm. that there's a consistent supply uniformly across the country. Secondly, that the drugs on that list are real.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, because that's another problem in China is the proliferation of fake and diluted drugs. So the third is to establish a uniform supply chain, because in the variegated world of drug suppliers in China and in other countries as well, there's a lot of room for some corruption to take place.
Sure.
And overcharging, undersupplying. So the essential drug list, I think, is a good step forward. But and the fourth aspect of this is that it mandates a set price on drugs, right? Mm-hmm. So premiums can't be charged. Well, this is all very good, but hospitals depend on that premium in order to finance the salaries and the operations, right? So unless you have another mechanism for supplementing what the EDL has mandated, some of the most understaffed and undersupplied healthcare facilities have problems even staying open.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. If you look at rural hospitals, I mean, there's estimates that, you know, the percentage of revenue that they realize from pharmaceuticals, you know, accounts for up to 90% of their mm-hmm. operating budget. Mm-hmm. Now, that's in very, very poor part of China. But the point is that unless, again, to go back to something we were talking about earlier, unless the Ministry of Finance steps up and really starts to fund some of these initiatives, it's going to be very difficult for what the Ministry of Health wants to do from a public policy point of view to actually have teeth.
So let's talk about the politics of healthcare. I know in America, as I think three of us in the room here are Americans, it is an incredibly politically divisive issue. I mean, it is if there's probably no more divisive issue in American life today, political life today. Are there competing factions, one advocating, say, a more market-oriented approach, one more sort of government solutions-centered in China? Does it break down that way? Maybe Dailian would be best positioned to answer that. Is there a political component to it?
You mean there are market?
Yeah, I mean, are there factions within the government, within the party, who are on opposing sides of the healthcare reform issue?
Yeah, actually, there is a big debate on mm-hmm. this healthcare reform issue, especially in 2005 to 2009. Yeah, and maybe one group at that time, at that year, there is a report said that the healthcare reform last time begins from 1997 failed because of the market mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it thinks that the problem of accessibility and affordability is because of the market. Because of the market.
Sure.
So this time, the new healthcare reform want to start more provided by the government.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they addressed it. The government put so much money, and also much of the money just go to the provider rather than the insurance. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think the same political division that exists in the United States Maybe the descriptions are a little bit different, but I think the same sort of divided house, if you will, exists in China.
The melody is recognizable, transposed.
Yeah, it is.
China.
I think that's exactly right. Yeah. You have people who think the government should continue to drive this, and you have other people that say, let's make sure there's plenty of space for the private sector to step up.
Which I think is a good segue into the private sector, the business end of it, which I think all three of you know a lot about. Mm-hmm. So where are the opportunities in China in healthcare for foreign businesses, and what threats does the Chinese pharma industry and the Chinese healthcare industry pose to foreign pharma and healthcare businesses?
Yeah, how open is it to foreign healthcare providers, foreign medical equipment manufacturers, foreign pharmaceutical companies?
Well, I can speak to that. So there's been huge numbers of regulations and reforms that have been put in place to incentivize the further investment from the private sector and from international investors. And I think wisely so, with the recognition that China has a huge problem of trying to provide basic healthcare services for the masses. If it incentivized private sector development, the private sector would be positioned to provide a premium level of service for this emerging middle class and wealthy people in China, which would relieve the public sector from having to provide those services. And when the private sector comes into play, they can take certain risks. They can innovate. They can try things out. They can do management practices that might actually be able to be replicated at some scale in the public sector. So I think that as Dalian talked about earlier, that there's currently about 12% of the hospitals are in the private sector. They account only now for about 4% of the patients. The goal in 2015, by 2015, is to have 20% of the healthcare facilities be in the private sector, which would require another additional 400,000 more beds between now and 2015.
Isn't this sort of begging for resentment from the seething people who can't afford that? They're watching now as the celebs and the wealthy go and have their babies at Beijing United Family, and they're not happy about how this is going. I mean, why it is that there's this bifurcation in society. Is there potential for political unrest because of this sort of thing? Ben, do you think?
I think there's definitely the potential. I mean, there's no way to talk about healthcare without acknowledging that it's definitely a source of inequity and tension. But I also think, to go back to what David was just saying, if you do see the private sector step up and create a lot of additional capacity in the healthcare space in China, that should free up some of the government's limited resources to be spent on areas where it's needed.
Theoretically, yeah.
In theory. So the question is, how does that really play out? You're going to watch things like, does the actual privatization of the VIP hospital wings, which is something the Ministry of Health has talked about doing, does that actually happen? And if it does, how does that shake out?
Is that not the case right now? I mean, like, I go to a research hospital, Peking Union Medical College, and they have a VIP wing there, and I mean, you pay exorbitant amounts of money. That's not private currently? It's not privatized?
No.
Okay, it feels private.
And actually, Shanghai has mandated that all hospitals do away with their VIP wings.
Right. They used to be called the Tejibu, and then it's been called something else. They've changed the name of it now, so it doesn't.
David, you think it's fair to say that there's some question as to whether or not that's going to be seen through?
I do think it's fair to say that.
There's a lot of revenue coming from those VIP wings.
Yeah, one of the fifth pillar of healthcare reform is piloting public hospital reforms, right? And 17 different cities have been in this pilot. And that's one of the things that's creating the biggest pushback. These hospitals don't want to give up their VIP wards because they do generate a fair amount of revenue.
It goes back to what we were just talking about with pharmaceuticals. These are hospitals that are operating under strained revenue conditions. So if you tell them, not only are we going to reform pharmaceuticals and we're going to set price points and we're going to set margin, but we're also going to ask you to obsolete your VIP wing, that just begs the question of, well, where You know, where is my revenue going to come from?
Can I ask one thing about the demographic bomb that we were kind of talking about a little bit before we started recording, we have the famous problem of China getting old very quickly before it gets rich, and a lot of old people and not too many young people support them. And we also have a country where suddenly everybody's eating KFC and chocolate and the kids are all fat and getting diabetes. So, I mean, are we
drinking
looking
craft
at
a, beer?
Cheers. Are we looking at a potential sort of apocalypse situation where you have a bunch of like fat kids and old people with diabetes who are all the victims of rich diseases and nothing works?
The largest population of gout sufferers in the history of mankind, right?
Well, actually, the answer is yes. Yeah. We are looking at that. Now, I'm a public health person at heart, right? So public health people look at populations and how, you know, where they're moving. But this is a serious problem with the aging of the population, the increasing percentage of non-communicable diseases, including obesity, the disparities between urban and poor, east and west, rich and poor. I'm sorry, but this is going to, if you look at if you play it out, the numbers of people aging and the incidence of hypertension, of smoking, of these, you see a situation that is really unsupportable. And this is what prompted health reform in America, the same kind of influence on the economy, because it ceases to be a problem of just public health people or medical people. Now, economists start to realize that how can we sustain an economy when we're devoting so much of our resources to healthcare?
Right.
In America, it's now 17% of GDP.
What's the comparable spend here?
About 5 or 6%, right? So there's room to increase the government spending in China. In America, you know, it's kind of the opposite problem. There's probably too much spending. So the apocalyptic scenario that you kind of posit, it's a real issue, and this is what prompts the people in government now to try and take this on, this very difficult issue of health reform.
But it's also an opportunity for the private sector, right?
A huge opportunity.
Yeah. It's an enormous opportunity. If you look at something as, you know, as complex as dementia care, you know, in China, it's estimated that by 2040 there will be more people with dementia in China than in the rest of the world put together. That's a byproduct of diets. It's a byproduct of a lot of things that you were just talking about. So the question becomes, in a country that has fewer than 50 dedicated dementia care clinics or any sort of dementia capacity all throughout the country, who's going to step up and provide those sort of services? And if you look at every sort of aged disease that goes alongside that, the capacity in the country just doesn't exist. And so there's an enormous opportunity for the private sector to step up. Now, obviously, the challenge is affordability, as with anything that we've talked about today. And so the question is, with, you know, something like dementia care, you know, how do you build out capacity that's meaningful in the country that the private sector can, you know, extract profit from?
Well, Ben, your company, Rubicon, I mean, it works in precisely this business. Yep. It helps in elderly care. I mean, it helps advise companies to enter the China market. Yep. And what are you seeing? Are you seeing a lot of business? Is your phone ringing off the hook?
Yeah, there's enormous interest in particularly higher acuity elder care like dementia care. Mm-hmm. But we're also seeing an enormous interest in home health care.
Right.
So the government, and obviously David can speak to this because they just recently in January actually announced a new service built around this. And they're very uniquely positioned to take advantage of this. But the government has stipulated that 90% of all senior care is going to be delivered as home health care. 7% is going to be delivered through the community hospital system, and 3% is going to be delivered through the nursing homes. So right out of the gate, to their credit actually, the Chinese government has recognized that to deal with this aging problem, we're going to need to have a reasonably, I don't know if sophisticated is the right term, but a very well built out home health care infrastructure.
Right. It's sort of a Confucian approach to it.
Well, and you know, if you look at, I was in Singapore last week, and if you actually look at what Singapore is doing, Singapore is struggling to even acknowledge that home health care needs to exist and create the openings in terms of regulatory space and immigration reform to bring in the sort of workers.
Right.
China at least is being honest about the problem and and saying, we need to craft policies that are designed to incentivize this sector.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating. You mentioned Singapore as a sort of anti-model for this. What countries should China be looking to?
Not the U.S.
Not the U.S. Okay. So what countries should China be looking to?
Not the U.S. It's a bad example, even from Chinese perspective.
What about Japan? Or?
Japan is very different. Yeah, but maybe
facing a similar demographic situation, right?
Yes, but maybe in the debate of 2006 to 2009, maybe some persons posed that maybe we should learn from France.
Okay.
Because there are some similarity. For example, the supply of healthcare is more provided by the public sectors in France,
mm-hmm.
and also they have some private sectors, and The other reason is that the insurance, they have the social insurance, maybe 70%, and the other insurance is provided by the commercial ones, the 30%. So maybe in China can learn from France.
Yeah, I think that China's best bet is to take best aspects from a variety of countries.
Of course.
It's so complex here, and mm-hmm. I think China has the opportunity to do exactly that, and it has proven effective at doing mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. in other mm-hmm. sectors. Mm-hmm. So I think it should do the same in healthcare.
There
needs to be a Chinese solution mm-hmm. to this. This is a uniquely Chinese mm-hmm. problem.
Mm-hmm. And this isn't all things.
Too complicated. Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks very much. I think this is a fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
I've learned a lot. I mean, Jeremy, you too, I'm sure.
Yeah, me too.
This is something that...
Each aspect is so fascinating, we had to kind of do a huge kind of helicopter view. We couldn't really get into any details.
But I'm sure this is a topic that we'll revisit in detail, looking at specific aspects of this in future podcasts, and I hope that we can see some of you again. So I want to very warmly thank you all for coming, Dr. David Grotstein, Ms. Dailian, and Ben Schubert. Yeah, I almost said Schubert.
That would have been okay, too.
Ben Schubert. Thanks so much for coming, all three of you.
Thank you for having us.
And folks, we'll see you next week on Seneca Podcast. I think we have Richard Berger coming on next week to talk about sex in China.